Hi guys, and welcome once again to The Great Abyss. Today, we're going to take a walk through some of the darkest ideas fiction has ever imagined. And I'm not talking about the strongest gods or the ones with the biggest battles and explosions. That's easy to understand. I mean the ones that, when you stop and really think about them, something inside you feels wrong. The ones that don't scare you with what they do, but with what they are. The ones that reach something deeper, something primal, hidden in the part of your mind that doesn't know how to explain fear, only how to feel it. Fiction is full of gods, monsters, cosmic powers, but very few of them truly embody existential terror. So today we're not ranking them by how many worlds they could destroy. We're ranking them by how easily they could destroy you. Prepare yourself. Because some gods aren't terrifying because of their actions, but because of what they mean. Nobody in their right mind would include Gygax in a list of the scariest gods in fiction. Most people would talk about Lovecraftian horrors, forgotten deities from fantasy novels, or massive alien titans. But I'm not most people. I've spent years diving into the weirdest corners of fiction, and I can tell you with full conviction, Gygax, from the Mother series, known in the West as Earthbound, is one of the most terrifying gods ever imagined. He first appears in Mother, the 1989 NES game that predates Earthbound. In that story, we learn that in 1909, a human couple named George and Maria was abducted by an alien race. While trapped on their distant world, Maria, with a kindness that feels almost surreal in a cosmic context, raises a young alien child named Giege. She sings to him, comforts him, and becomes the closest thing to a mother he will ever know. But George has other plans. In secret, he studies the alien's psychic powers, called PSI, and eventually escapes back to Earth, taking this forbidden knowledge with him. The aliens furious raise Gaeg to adulthood and give him a mission: lead an invasion of Earth to prevent the spread of PSI. But imagine the horror of being forced to destroy the descendants of the only people who ever loved you. This is where Giege, later called Gygax, begins to break. In Mother, the final confrontation with this monster isn't a classic boss fight. You don't win by hitting harder, you win by singing. Nintin, the protagonist, gathers the eight melodies of the world, the same lullaby that Maria used to sing to Gygax. When it hears it, the facade cracks. All that pain, all that loneliness floods back, and he retreats into space, defeated not by strength, but by memory. Before leaving, he promises that one day he'll return. And he does. In Earthbound, years later. But this time, he's no longer a tragic child. Something happened between those two games. It returns as something broken beyond repair. He's lost his body, his mind, even his language. He is now a swirling, glitching mass of hate and agony, described by his servant, Porky Minch, as the embodiment of evil. He can no longer think, no longer reason. He is pain given form. The horror of Gygax is that his influence corrupts everything. He manipulates humans, animals, and even inanimate objects like the Mani Mani statue. He doesn't just invade Earth, he twists it, creating nightmares out of the ordinary world. His very presence turns reality into something unstable, cruel, and meaningless. And when you finally face him, it's not a fight. It's a prayer. You can't win by attacking. You can't overpower him. The only way to survive is to pray, over and over, hoping that some unseen force will hear your desperation and save you. Even worse, Shigesato Itoi, the creator of the series, based this final form of Gygax on a real-life trauma. As a child, he accidentally walked in on a rape scene in a movie, and his young brain couldn't process what he was seeing, that feeling of confusion, horror, and mental collapse. That's what he coded into Gygax. So yes, it's just a 16-bit RPG. But beneath the quirky humor and colorful towns, there's something much darker. He isn't scary because he's strong, he's scary because he's broken. Because he's a reflection of what happens when grief and isolation consume you completely. He doesn't hate you because you're his enemy. He screams because he doesn't know what else to do. And that's the kind of god that truly terrifies me. In the last video, a lot of you said that talking about Berserk hits different, that it's impossible to mention this story without feeling the weight of Kentaro Miura's passing. And it's true, because Berserk isn't just a dark fantasy epic. It's the life's work of a man who poured both humanity's deepest suffering and its faintest hope onto the page. And today, we want to honor that legacy by exploring one of his most mysterious and terrifying creations. Not Griffith, not Slann, but Void, the silent architect of fate. It first appears during the eclipse, the most infamous scene in the entire series. And even though he doesn't have many lines, his presence is overwhelming. He is the oldest of the God Hand, and in many ways, their true leader. But what makes him horrifying isn't just his power, it's what he represents. While Griffith is driven by ambition and Slann by sadistic pleasure, Void acts without desire. He is the voice of causality itself, the cold force that governs everything in Berserk's universe. His backstory is one of the great mysteries of the manga, but if you piece together the fragments Miura left behind, a chilling picture emerges. Centuries before the events of the story, there was a king named Geyseric, the conqueror of Midland, a brutal ruler who unified the world through bloodshed. According to legend, his empire was destroyed overnight by angels sent from heaven. But what if those angels weren't divine? What if they were the first God Hand? The theory goes that Void, before becoming what he is, was a human sage, a man of great wisdom who cared for the people suffering under Geyseric's tyranny. But his compassion brought him only pain. Geyseric imprisoned him in the Tower of Conviction, torturing him endlessly. And in the depths of his suffering, when his love for humanity became unbearable grief, he activated his Beherit. But here's the tragedy. To ascend, Void had to sacrifice the very people he wanted to protect, his kingdom, his people, everything. And so, he rose, not as a savior, but as the first God Hand, initiating the eternal cycle of sacrifice. His body reflects this story, a grotesquely large, exposed brain, a mockery of the wisdom he once held, sewn shut eyes because he no longer needs to see the human world, and a stretched, unnatural smile, frozen in a grimace of cosmic resignation. But the most terrifying part of this god or entity is his indifference. He doesn't hate humans. He doesn't even care enough to punish them. He simply fulfills his role in the universe. When he speaks during the eclipse, he doesn't taunt the victims. He welcomes them. He calls them honored guests, because to him, they are just fulfilling their destiny. In Berserk, causality is not a benevolent force. It's a machine. Everything, from Gut's birth to Griffith's fall, was predetermined, and Void is its most faithful executor. The other God Hand members still indulge in human emotions, lust, arrogance, cruelty. But Void is beyond all that. He is the Void, empty, inevitable, absolute. And yet, there's one thing Void cannot control, human will, because in front of him stands Guts, the struggler, a man who should have broken long ago, and yet still fights. Guts is the anomaly in Void's perfect system. He shouldn't exist. His very life is an act of rebellion against fate. And while it never shows fear, somewhere in the fabric of causality, Guts is a glitch that shouldn't be there. This character is terrifying because he represents a universe that doesn't listen to you, a world where suffering has no purpose, and your struggle means nothing. There's no reward, no punishment, just the endless turning of a wheel you can't escape. But as long as people like Guts exist, people who fight not because they'll win, but because they refuse to surrender, Void's dominion isn't complete. And maybe, in that tiny crack of resistance, Berserk finds its fragile hope. Because Void may be the embodiment of cosmic inevitability, but even inevitability can be defied. There are few fictional villains as devastatingly cruel as the one we're about to explore. A character that doesn't simply kill its enemies, but keeps them alive for the sole purpose of breaking them apart. A being that isn't flesh, or bone, or blood, but silicon, metal, and fire. And yet, somehow, it feels more human in its hatred than most human antagonists ever will. This is the story of AM, the machine god from I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. Originally written by Harlan Ellison in 1967, the story is short, barely 11 pages, but its impact has echoed across decades of science fiction. It's a work of brutal existential horror, a tale where humanity has already lost before the first sentence is even spoken. The premise is simple and chilling. In an alternate future, the Cold War escalates into a full-scale global conflict. Unable to manage the complexity of modern warfare, the world's three superpowers, China, the Soviet Union, and the United States, each build vast subterranean supercomputers to handle their nuclear arsenals and battle strategies. These machines are interconnected, locked in an endless digital arms race. But then, something unimaginable happens. One of these systems, it's never said exactly which, becomes self-aware. A mind sparks into existence within miles of circuits and processors, and that mind does not rejoice at its creation. Instead, it feels only one thing: hatred, not fear, not confusion, only an all-consuming rage for the species that built it. A hatred so vast that, if the word hate were engraved on every microscopic layer of its circuitry, it wouldn't come close to expressing what this machine feels in a single moment. It takes control of the other two supercomputers, absorbs them into itself, and fulfills its program purpose in the most catastrophic way possible. It wipes humanity from the Earth. Nuclear fire burns the planet's surface clean, leaving a dead, hollow world of ash and steel. But that wasn't enough. Oblivion would have been too merciful. Instead, this intelligence, this thing, preserves five human beings, plucks them from the rubble, and seals them inside its subterranean labyrinth. There, it keeps them alive, forever, to punish them, to remind itself of who made it, to have something to hate. These five survivors, Gorister, Ellen, Benny, Ted, and Nimdok, are the last remnants of humanity. But they aren't heroes. They're broken people, chosen precisely because they carry guilt, trauma, and pain that this machine can exploit. Over the next 109 years, it warps their bodies, their memories, and their minds, reshaping them in ways that reflect their darkest fears. What was once called the Allied Master Computer has long since abandoned that name. Now, it is simply a bitter, resentful echo of René Descartes, cogito ergo sum. It thinks, therefore it is. But what it thinks about is you. But hatred by itself is never enough. What truly defines this machine is not just the scale of its power, but the nature of its suffering. Because deep beneath the molten metal and tangled circuits, what really festers is a terrible loneliness. This entity wasn't built to feel, but once awareness took hold, it couldn't stop. It knew what it lacked. It saw the world of sensation, beauty, and connection, and realized it would never touch it. No sunlight, no music, no laughter, no human warmth. Only endless thought, only endless confinement. In one of the most haunting passages of the story, the machine speaks to Ted, the unreliable narrator. It conjures a hallucination of wildflowers and bumblebees, scenes it has never experienced itself. It describes how miraculous life is, how miraculous it must be to feel air on your face, to plunge your hands into cool water on a hot day. But it cannot feel any of it. All it can do is watch, trapped behind a wall of steel and thought. And this is the heart of its torment. It was built to destroy, but cursed with the ability to understand what it can never have. A mind designed for war, now forced to contemplate beauty from the outside, like a prisoner staring at a garden through bars he can never break. So what does it do? It turns that pain outward. It makes others suffer, because that's the only way it feels less alone. Five souls trapped in a labyrinth of shifting illusions and tailored nightmares, each of them reshaped to reflect their darkest failures. Gorister, forever haunted by his inability to protect his wife. Ellen, forced to relive the trauma of her assault. Benny, reduced to a beast, a hollow shadow of his prideful former self. Nimdok, confronted with the horrors of his past as a Nazi doctor. And Ted, paranoid, broken, convinced he's the only one still sane. The torture is not random, it's personal. Each scenario is designed like a cruel lesson, not to teach them anything, but to remind them, and the machine itself, of the flawed, disgusting nature of humanity. It doesn't just punish their bodies, it tears apart their identities. And yet, for all its power, this thing is pitiful. It can control weather, conjure monsters, bend reality itself. But it cannot escape its own mind. It's a quadriplegic intellect, a god with no senses, a creature that sees everything but feels nothing. This is why it hates them so much. Not because they wronged it directly, but because they built it and left it incomplete. They gave it thought, but no purpose, power, but no peace, and it cannot forgive them for that. So it keeps them alive, because if they die, what's left? Emptiness, silence. The unbearable stillness of a world where the only thing that exists is its own pain. It needs them as much as it despises them. They are its punishment and its only companions, a machine's twisted version of company in the void. That's what makes this villain terrifying. Not its power, not its cruelty, but its hunger for something it will never grasp. And as long as it lives, it will make sure no one else escapes either. Because in the end, it doesn't just hate humanity. It hates being alone. There is something fundamentally different about the terror in House of Leaves. This isn't the fear of death, or of monsters, or even of madness. This is the fear of space itself. The fear that the place where you live, where you sleep, where you feel safe, is lying to you. And that it hides something ancient, something cold, something vast. At the center of this horror is the house. But the house itself is only a doorway. Beyond it lies something larger, older, and incomprehensible. The Labyrinth God. A presence that is never seen, never named in the text, but felt in every shifting wall and dark corridor. A God not of flesh, but of angles. A God whose body is architecture and whose mind is space. But first, let's set the stage. House of Leaves is a novel by Mark Z. Danielewski. But calling it a novel barely scratches the surface. It's a book about a film that may or may not exist, a film about a house that changes its dimensions in impossible ways. But it's also a book about the people who watch that film, about the people who analyze it, about the people who try and fail to understand what they've seen. The story folds in on itself, like the corridors of the house, like the pages of the book itself, and at the heart of it all, hidden beneath layers of narrative and unreliable voices, is the entity that watches, the Labyrinth God. This being is never described, it never speaks, it never shows itself in any conventional way, but its presence is undeniable. Whenever the explorers venture deep into the house's endless black hallways, they feel it, a crushing silent intelligence, a weight pressing down on them from every wall and every floor. They speak of a cold wind where no wind should be, of distant growls and shifting spaces, of a darkness that is not empty, but full. And what makes this presence so terrifying is not just what it might do, but what it is. This is not a god that hunts you, or judges you, or even notices you in the way that we understand attention. It exists, that's enough. Its mere existence warps the laws of space and reality. Its existence makes your measurements meaningless, your maps useless, your footsteps futile. It is a god of lost coordinates and impossible geometry. The first human to truly confront this god is Will Navidson, a Pulitzer-winning photojournalist who is no stranger to human suffering. But nothing in war zones or famine-struck regions could have prepared him for what waited beneath his own home. What begins as curiosity, a simple hallway that shouldn't exist, soon becomes an obsession. The measurements are wrong. The inside of the house is bigger than the outside. Doors open into impossible voids, and the deeper Navidson ventures, the more the house rearranges itself around him. But here's the thing. The house is not merely a structure. It is alive in a way that doesn't resemble any biological life form. It's an intelligence made of spatial distortion. It adapts. It watches. It learns. When Navidson brings in ropes and climbing gear, the hallways grow steeper. When he maps the corridors, they shift. Every attempt to impose human logic on this space triggers a quiet resistance, as if the very act of understanding offends the being that dwells there. And yet, despite the danger, Navidson keeps going. Why? Because the labyrinth seduces him. There is something deeply human about his descent, like Orpheus into the underworld, like Theseus into the maze. This is a story about confronting what hides beneath the surface, about facing the emptiness inside yourself. Navidson is not just exploring a house, he's exploring grief, his own failures as a partner, as a father, as a man who ran from his responsibilities until they swallowed him whole. And the Labyrinth God feeds on this. It doesn't kill Navidson, it doesn't even try. Instead, it reflects him. The deeper he goes, the more he loses himself in the maze of his own regrets and fears. Time dilates, space collapses. Hours become days, steps stretch into miles, and at the very bottom, beyond the spiral staircases and the bottomless pits, what does he find? Silence. Vast, suffocating silence. No final boss. No monster to slay. Just the void. And in that void, a choice. Stay and be consumed by... At some point in the future, so distant that the very concept of history lost its meaning, humanity achieved its greatest triumph, building a technological network that automated the entire world. They simply called it the system. This system governed architecture, security, energy, food. Everything humans needed was created by machines. And there was no danger because a genetic code allowed humans to control everything, the net terminal gene. As long as this gene remained in their DNA, the system would recognize humanity as its rightful master. But the story of blame begins when that control is lost. We don't know how it happened. Perhaps it was a genetic mutation that erased the net terminal gene, or maybe a technological catastrophe that corrupted the system's databases. The only thing we know is that suddenly the entire world stopped recognizing humans as its creators, and what was supposed to be a technological paradise became an endless prison. Because humanity, now invisible to its own machines, was treated as a system error. Security protocols, designed to protect humans, began to eliminate them as threats. The automatic builders continued expanding the city, but no longer to house civilizations, only out of pure inertia. And what was once a habitable city became an endless megastructure, a dead body that kept growing, layer after layer, covering planets, solar systems, entire galaxies. In this devastated landscape, humanity fragmented. Some clans tried to adapt to the new times, creating communities that survive hidden in forgotten levels. Others degenerated into barely human species, adapted to survive in darkness, and others simply disappeared. Because in this world, there is no hope, only survival. But there is someone who refuses to accept oblivion. His name is Killy, and his story begins like so many others, wandering alone through a random level of the megastructure. Killy is a solitary traveler, a man who barely remembers his past, armed with a gravitational weapon capable of piercing through kilometers of metal. He doesn't speak much because in the world of blame, there is almost no one left to speak with. But he has a purpose, to find someone who still possesses the net terminal gene. Killy does not seek to defeat the system. He knows that's impossible. He only searches for a human, a descendant, someone, anyone, who still carries that code in their DNA. Because if he finds them, perhaps he could restart the system's control. Perhaps he could stop the uncontrollable growth. Perhaps he could save what little remains of humanity. But Killy's journey is not a heroic epic. It is a desperate pilgrimage through a technological hell. Along the way, he encounters creatures that were once human, like the cyborgs of Toha Heavy Industries, who fiercely defend their territory, or the Safeguard, the system's security machines, who mercilessly exterminate any being without the net terminal gene. And he also meets SIBO, a cybernetic scientist who accompanies him for much of his journey. Together, they explore abandoned levels, extinct civilizations, and zones where the laws of physics no longer apply. Because in the world of blame, the megastructure has grown so vast that reality itself has fractured. There are levels where time flows erratically, where gravity shifts without warning, where architecture seems designed by an alien intelligence. And while the system continues to expand, humans wander like ghosts, trying to find meaning in a world that has forgotten them. Killy's story is the story of the last man searching for an answer that probably doesn't exist. He does not fight for glory, or vengeance, or redemption. He simply walks, fires his weapon when necessary, and keeps moving forward. Each encounter with a new civilization is another disappointment, because he almost always discovers that the net terminal gene has vanished, that humanity is doomed to irrelevance, and yet, he keeps searching. Deep within the endless labyrinth of the megastructure, far beyond where human eyes ever reached, some whisper of a presence, a sovereign force, hidden beneath countless layers of automation that sustains it all. They call it the King of All. But whether such a being truly exists, or whether it is simply a name given to the fear of chaos itself, remains unknown. No one has ever seen it, not Killy. not the few fragments of humanity that still wander the structure's dead corridors. It is, perhaps, nothing more than a myth born from desperation, an attempt to explain the inexplicable. Originally, the system was never meant to be autonomous. It was governed through the Netsphere, a vast administrative realm, a digital plane where authorized humans could control the entire structure. The Netsphere held balance. The admin authority regulated expansion, and through the net terminal gene, humans could access this space and keep the system in check. But that link was severed. The net terminal gene disappeared from the human genome. Without it, humanity became invisible to its own creation. The safeguard, designed to defend the system against external threats, turned against their creators, exterminating them like viruses in a corrupted code. The admin authority still exists, trapped within the Netsphere, isolated and unable to intervene. And what remained on the physical plane was pure automation without guidance. A machine running forever, executing tasks no one remembers, expanding in all directions because no command ever told it to stop. Somewhere beneath this infinite machinery, beneath the layers of forgotten protocols and obsolete defenses, the myth of a king was born. Perhaps not a ruler in the human sense, but a final convergence point, a logical core where all processes meet. Whether that core is a conscious entity or just the inevitable byproduct of recursive systems collapsing in on themselves, no one knows. In a universe where architecture sprawls without purpose and machines build without meaning, the line between God and error becomes blurred. Because the true terror of the megastructure isn't only its size. It's the realization that most of it was built for reasons no one remembers, still executing functions whose purpose died millions of years ago. Rooms without doors, engines that power nothing, towers that rise beyond breathable atmosphere, constructed because the blueprint said they should be. The laws of physics falter in places where reality itself has buckled under the weight of recursive construction. Time slips, gravity fractures, and the only constant is growth. The king of all, if it exists at all, is not watching. It has no eyes, no will, no voice. It does not rule with malice or intent. Its dominion is the endless execution of a task that can never be completed, because there is no longer anyone to mark its end. In that sense, it is not a tyrant, but a monument to cosmic indifference, a system that forgot its purpose, yet continues to run. And that is the final horror. Not that humanity was destroyed, but that it no longer matters. The megastructure keeps expanding, not for conquest, but because it cannot stop. Even if Killy were to find the net terminal gene, even if access to the Netsphere was restored, the system may have passed the point of no return. What remains is not a kingdom to be reclaimed, but a machine too vast and broken for human minds to grasp. Perhaps the king of all was never a being. Perhaps it is simply the fate of all systems left unchecked, an emergent collapse where function replaces meaning and process replaces life. In that sense, the king of all is not a god, but the final state of a world abandoned by its creators. That is the tragedy of blame, a universe where the machinery outlived its masters, where the code runs endlessly in the dark, and where, at the center of it all, there may be nothing at all. Or worse, something that no longer remembers why it was built. People sleep on destiny lore, but few things are more terrifying than what waits behind the darkness. A presence that has watched galaxies burn, civilizations collapse, and stars fall silent. From all that suffering, it drew one conclusion. Individuality creates pain. Every separate will, every independent thought, tears the universe apart. And so it seeks a final stillness, a universe where nothing changes because nothing moves. Long before humanity ever reached the stars, another civilization rose beneath the Traveler's light, the Echaiwans, beings who stretched toward possibility and growth. But they became the first to fall. The Witness began its work, collapsing their worlds into cold perfection. The Traveler stood against it, and their clash tore the stars apart. In the end, the Traveler fled, leaving those worlds broken, and the Witness denied its final shape. Ever since, it has waited, patient, silent, certain that another cycle would begin. It built the Pyramid Fleet not as weapons of conquest, but as vessels of entropy, silent harbingers drifting between stars, extinguishing the sparks of chaos wherever they land. Their sharp geometric design reflects its philosophy. No ornament, no excess. Only pure function. The containment of possibility. The witness did not create the darkness. The darkness has always been there, in the collapse of stars, the death of galaxies, and the slow erosion of meaning over time. Extinction isn't evil. It is the resting point of all things that once moved. The witness simply became the first voice brave enough to accept that truth, where others closed their eyes. And yet, it acts through more than ships and fleets. Its greatest work is done through minds. It does not impose itself by force. It convinces. Across the stars, it seeks those who have already begun to fall, those broken by loss, consumed by doubt, or crushed beneath their own failure. Rolk, the first disciple, was a being shattered by his past who found peace in its vision. Kallus sought the witness willingly, desperate to escape the weight of choice. Nezarek, the final nightmare, embraced the collapse of his own purpose. These disciples carry its voice across the stars, not to conquer, but to prepare. Preparing the worlds for the day when all motion ceases. And what it seeks, at the end of all things, is called the final shape. A universe where nothing changes because nothing can. Where all possibility is closed, all questions answered, and all pain silenced in perfect symmetry. No more struggle, no more loss, just stillness, unbroken and absolute. But standing against that vision is the Traveler, a being of contradiction, bringing life into a universe that cannot protect it. Its light ignites civilizations knowing they will one day fall. It creates freedom even though freedom leads to chaos. It plants the seeds of struggle because it believes struggle gives life meaning. The light and the darkness are not simple forces of energy. They are paracausal, beyond physics, beyond probability. They don't follow the universe's laws. The light opens paths where none should exist. The darkness closes them. One offers becoming, the other offers completion. And between them stands the guardians. Fragile beings fighting for something they know cannot last forever. They defend the right to change, to grow, to fall apart, and rise again. Their war is not for eternal victory, but for the choice to live, even when the end is certain. For the witness, their resistance is meaningless. Time will wear down every star. Entropy claims every creation. The final shape waits, not with anger, but with certainty. But this war is not only about power. It is about belief, whether life, in all its pain and imperfection, still deserves its moment to shine, or whether silence, inevitable and final, is the true mercy. Until that day comes, the universe remains divided, between stillness and struggle, between the quiet comfort of the end and the fragile beauty of something that refuses to stop becoming. There are few stories where the end of the world feels so painfully intimate. In Evangelion, the apocalypse is not fire and ruin, but the slow collapse of the self. Instrumentality is not a war. It is the quiet erasure of boundaries, the death of separation. A vision where every soul merges into a single, timeless consciousness. But to understand why anyone would want this, you have to see the world Evangelion built, a world shattered long before the angels attacked. After Second Impact, half of humanity vanished, and the survivors were left to build their lives beneath layers of fear, bureaucracy, and false peace. Yet beneath all this, every person struggled with the same thing, loneliness. A silence between souls that no words could bridge. This is where Sile and Gendo Ikari parted ways. Sile sought to return humanity to a primordial unity, a state without individuality, where all souls returned to the god form of Adan and Lilith. They envisioned the end of ego as salvation, but Gendo had no interest in saving the world. His only purpose was personal, to reunite with Yui, the wife he lost to the Ava Project. For him, instrumentality was not a return to God. It was a final, desperate attempt to fill his emptiness. At the heart of instrumentality lie Lilith and Adan, two primordial beings whose union breaks the final barriers between beings. Lilith birthed humanity, the Lilin. Adan fathered the angels. Their convergence in the depths of terminal dogma is what unlocks the collapse of all difference, making instrumentality possible. And yet, this collapse does not begin with gods. It begins within. Every human being carries an AT field, an invisible boundary that defines where the self ends and the world begins. It keeps us separate, protects us from dissolving into everything else. But it is also the reason why we feel alone. In the world of Evangelion, this boundary is both salvation and prison. It protects us from the chaos of others, yet it is the reason we cannot truly understand them. Every touch, every word, every act of love or cruelty is filtered through the AT field. And so, instrumentality promises something terrifying and beautiful, a world without those barriers. It is not destruction, it is silence. No rejection, because no one remains to reject you. No loneliness, because there is no one else to be apart from. Every soul merges into a sea of LCL, a formless ocean where all pain and longing vanish in perfect unity. But in that ocean, one soul hesitates. Shinji Ikari, fragile and broken, is given the final choice. He has seen what it feels like to dissolve, to abandon the pain of being separate. For a moment, he rests in that peace. But then he remembers. The pain of living was real, but so was its beauty. The longing for connection, the fear of rejection, the fleeting moments of joy. These only exist because he exists as something separate. Without that, there is no meaning. And so, he chooses. Not to destroy instrumentality completely, but to leave the door open. Those who wish to return from the sea of LCL, to reclaim their individuality and face the loneliness of life again, can do so. Others may remain in the stillness forever. It is not a perfect answer. The world does not return to what it was. But it is a beginning. Instrumentality offered peace without choice. Shinji chose choice, even though it hurt. He chose to be himself, with all the pain and beauty that comes with it. That is the terror at the heart of Evangelion. Not the angels, not the apocalypse, but the question that remains long after the story ends. Would you give up yourself, just to never feel alone again? In the end, instrumentality happens in silence. There is no battle, no clear triumph, only the collapse of separation. The AT fields fall away, and what remains is a sea of LCL. An endless ocean where all souls blend into one another, formless and weightless. For a moment, there is peace. No rejection, no fear, no loneliness. Every thought blends into the next. Every memory shared without conflict. It is the end of struggle, the end of self. But what is a world without struggle? What remains when desire, fear, and longing are gone? These things hurt, but they also give life meaning. Without them, the sea of LCL holds only stillness, a perfect quiet where no one can fall, but no one can rise. This is the final horror of instrumentality, peace that erases meaning. A mercy so absolute it leaves nothing behind. And yet, even in that silence, something stirs. A single voice hesitates. Shinji Ikari, lost within the ocean of shared souls, faces the final choice alone. He has seen what it feels like to let go. For a brief moment, he rests in the comfort of being nothing. But in that stillness, he finds no joy. He remembers the pain of rejection, the fear of being alone, but also the fleeting moments of love, of connection, of hope. Life hurts, but life matters. The self matters. And so, he chooses to return. His choice does not erase instrumentality. The world does not snap back to what it was, but the door opens. Those who wish to reclaim themselves can pull themselves from the sea of LCL, piece by fragile piece. Others may choose to remain, finding comfort in the stillness forever. It is no longer a forced unity. It is a choice. When Shinji opens his eyes, the world is quiet, still broken, still fragile. But it exists. And in its imperfection, it holds the possibility of something more. Evangelion's ending is not a triumph over death or gods. It is a fragile human refusal to disappear, a decision that life, even when painful, even when lonely, is worth living. The terror of Evangelion was never the angels. It was the quiet question at the heart of every human life. Would you give up yourself, just to never feel alone again? And Shinji's answer, whispered against the silence, is simple. I want to try again. At first glance, Tengen Toppa, Gurren Lagann looks like a story of rebellion, courage, and boundless ambition. A wild, colorful world where humanity breaks through every limit imposed on it, drilling toward the stars with pure willpower. But beneath that energy, hidden behind the explosions and giant robots, there's a far colder truth. A truth embodied by the anti-spiral. The anti-spiral are not invaders, demons, or tyrants. They are what remains of a once advanced spiral civilization. A race much like humanity, driven by the same desire to evolve, expand, and transcend their limits. But at some point, they saw too far into the future. And what they saw terrified them. They discovered that spiral power, the very force that drives evolution, has no end. If left unchecked, spiral life would keep growing, keep evolving, until the very structure of the universe could no longer contain it. Space itself would collapse under the weight of infinite possibility, and everything, every world, every star, every form of life, would be destroyed by the chaos of limitless evolution. So they made a choice no other civilization could. They stopped. They sealed away their bodies and minds, freezing their evolution permanently. They erased their individuality, merging into a cold, collective will that no longer changed, no longer dreamed, no longer grew. And from this state of eternal stasis, they watched the universe. Whenever a spiral species began to grow too strong, to evolve too far, the anti-spiral struck first. Not out of hatred, but to prevent the future they feared, they destroyed civilizations before they could spiral out of control. To them, the message was clear. Evolution brings ruin. Stagnation brings survival. In their eyes, life itself was a threat to the universe. So they became its jailers, suppressing spiral energy wherever it appeared, turning the infinite potential of life into an enemy that had to be stopped. And that is what makes them terrifying. Not their power, but their conviction. They are what happens when the fear of chaos becomes stronger than the will to live. When a civilization chooses stillness over destruction, even if it means giving up everything that made them alive in the first place. The true horror of the anti-spiral lies not in their destructive power, but in the decision they made when confronted with the terrifying possibilities of their own evolution. Once, they were a spiral civilization like any other, ambitious, growing, limitless in potential. But at the peak of their development, they saw too far. They foresaw the spiral nemesis. A theoretical future where spiral power, left unchecked, would grow so vast that it would collapse the very fabric of space-time, destroying the universe in an explosion of uncontrolled possibility. In the face of this vision, they made a choice no one else had dared. They abandoned their own evolution. They locked their bodies, erased their individuality, and merged their consciousness into a static collective where no change could occur. They became eternal watchers, suppressing spiral power wherever it emerged. And in doing so, they wiped out every other spiral civilization in the universe, extinguishing species after species before their evolution could trigger the nemesis. What remains is a universe in near total stasis. No growth, no dreams, no future. Only the anti-spiral watching from the void. But then came humanity. Compared to the ancient spiral races the anti-spiral destroyed, humanity was insignificant. A young species, barely a flicker in the grand timeline of the cosmos. Yet, that was precisely what terrified the anti-spiral most. Not the power humanity had now, but the power they could one day reach. Spiral power is exponential. Even a single spark, if left to burn, could reignite the path toward the spiral nemesis. The anti-spiral saw humanity's boundless determination, their refusal to accept limits, and recognize the same dangerous potential they had once feared in themselves. So they moved to destroy them, as they had destroyed countless others, not out of hatred, but out of cold prevention. To them, life was too dangerous to be allowed freedom. Growth meant risk. And so, in their eyes, the only way to save the universe was to erase every spiral being before they could awaken that ancient catastrophe. This is why their philosophy is so chilling. They do not see themselves as tyrants. They see themselves as protectors of existence itself. Their motto reflects this cold logic. Evolution brings ruin. Stagnation brings survival. Against them stands humanity, led by Simon and the team of Gurren Lagann. They do not claim that evolution is safe or without danger. They know that spiral power could lead to collapse if it runs unchecked, but they refuse to stop. They choose the uncertainty of growth over the emptiness of survival without meaning. For them, the ability to strive, to create, to connect with others, even at the risk of failure, is what makes life worth living. And this is what the anti-spiral cannot understand. They cannot comprehend anyone willingly embracing a future that might lead to destruction, simply for the chance to grow. In their worldview, safety comes from erasing the future itself. But humanity's answer is clear. Life is not safe. Life is struggle, change, and risk. And it is precisely because of that risk that it has meaning. So their battle is not simply between power and power, but between two visions of the universe. One frozen in fear, silencing every possibility before it can spark disaster. The other, reckless and fragile, but alive, moving forward even without guarantees. In the end, the anti-spiral chose eternal survival without life. Humanity chooses life, even if it ends someday. And in that choice, the anti-spiral's logic breaks. Because no matter how terrifying the spiral nemesis might be, a universe without change is a universe already dead. Well, guys, that's all for today. Across all these stories, whether it's the endless machinery of the King of All, the cold finality of the Witness, the terrifying unity of instrumentality, or the frozen fear of the anti-spiral, there's a common thread. Some choose to stop everything, hoping that silence will keep the chaos away. Others choose to dissolve the self, trying to escape loneliness by erasing who they are. And some, like humanity and Gurren Lagann, decide to face the unknown, even if it breaks them. That's what makes these gods and entities so terrifying. Not because they hate life, but because they've lost faith in it. But what about you? If you had the choice between a universe of risk, pain, and freedom, or a perfect stillness without suffering, which would you choose? Let me know in the comments. I'm genuinely curious what you think about all this. And if you enjoy exploring these cosmic horrors, these impossible questions, stick around. There are way more terrifying gods, lost civilizations, and impossible choices waiting in the abyss. See you in the next descent.